Chapter 19. Readiness. Weapons weren't the only part of the Keelan clan's preparations for whatever came next with the Narthani. Weapons required trained men to use those weapons effectively. The men needed logistics to fight, as did the rest of the Keelan populace, if the Narthani interrupted food production and if the people fled to secure locations farther inland. In addition, Yosef believed that for the clans to create the most effective fighting force, they needed to learn and accept fighting together with men of different clans, which included taking orders from someone not of their own clan. Training as Dragoons. Even if Yosef's ideas seemed strange to Dennis, once he understood, he quickly moved on to implementation. Yosef often wondered whether Dennis was a natural military commander. After Moreland City, no one needed further convincing of the futility of pure cavalry against cannon and massed infantry. Though the Cadelli might ride to battle on horseback, all of them needed to learn to fight afoot, if necessary, once they found the enemy. On Earth, the early Dragoons had been infantry trained well enough to stay on a horse and be able to ride to the battlefield before dismounting and fighting on foot. Over time, the definition and function had changed in Earth history, but the basic concept remained relevant for Cadellium. In the clan's case, however, it would be more a matter of experienced horsemen learning to fight as infantry rather than the other way around as on Earth. Dragoons had two inherent disadvantages. Losses of horses needed to be kept to a minimum to maintain mobility, meaning the horses had to be kept well back from the fighting and guarded from any flanking attacks that might drive them off. Second, someone had to do the holding and the guarding. Typically, one man and four held the horses, while the other three men fought. Thus, a 100-man company would have only 75 men to serve as infantry facing an enemy. Where rapid changes in positions were not anticipated, fewer men could hold the horses. To counter the disadvantages, a Cadelli Dragoon often equaled an enemy cavalryman and could outmaneuver any pure infantry. Consistent with the necessity to move quickly, Yosef pushed producing enough light artillery to accompany the Dragoons. Kalich had ordered all Keelan fighting men trained to operate in dual roles, their traditional role as cavalry and as infantry that rode to the battle site. Dennis had begun with men at Abersford, then more at Clengoth and Kernford. These men then served as cadre for training throughout Keelan province. Eventually, all Keelan fighters would be so trained, and Dennis found himself, to his consternation, spending more time in an administrative role overseeing training throughout Keelan and coordinating cadre training for other clans. Metok, Gwilymer, Hewell, and Adris already had sent men, and now Stent and Olrose joined in, sending men for training as dragoons and using the new six-pounders. The training itself was not complex. Having no formal experience in infantry tactics, and with only what Yosef could dredge out of his memory, Dennis focused on simply teaching the men to go quickly from mounted to dismounted and back, coordinate with the six-pounder artillery, and stay together as companies, platoons, and squads. As primitive as this infantry training was, it turned out to be a fortuitous foundation for unexpected opportunities that would occur. You're Cadelli, not a clansman. As Kulch had said to the other headmen at the conclave, Keelan would intensify preparation for whatever came. Two actions consisted of increasing the training and making a massive effort to store food in case war interrupted production for up to a year. All three of Yosef's shadows contributed to the training. Baal was taught horsemanship, because his years of growing up on a horse ranch enabled him and a horse to seemingly blend into a single entity whenever he mounted, even with a horse he had never before touched. Most Cadelli men were already experienced riders, though not all, especially men raised and working within towns, and even the experienced writers had things to learn. Y4 Kales organized group lessons in blade fighting. Watching one session reminded Yosef of historical movies and the training sessions of gladiators or legionnaires. Y4 perfectly filled the role of the experienced warrior screaming at novices. Carnegie's role came into being one evening while he shared beers with Dennis, Balwis, and Yosef at the Snarling Greco 2 in Kernford. The second round of steins arrived at their table when Yosef noticed that Dennis appeared even more dour than usual. The man, loyal to the clan and personally fearless, though not reckless, had turned into an important leader. He only occasionally appeared at the pub, and even on his good days, did not make the cheeriest of drinking companions. "What's up, Dennis? You're not your usual ebullient self." Dennis cast a baleful eye at Yosef's quip, then sighed and slammed his stein on the table. "With so much to do, I'm spending far too much time with the mixed clan men we're training." Yosef proposed the idea that on some occasions, men from different clans would have to fight together and even serve under the orders of a leader not from their own clan. College endorsed the idea, and Lewis and Dennis accepted the reasoning. The historical focus on clan independence and chauvinism toward clan membership would cause chaos during a battle. To counter these effects, a battalion-sized unit composed of men from all members of the Five-Clan Alliance had begun training outside Kernford. The 100 men from each clan made up platoon-sized units composed of all five clans. The intent was to create a cadre of leaders with experience in commanding mixed-clan fighters. These men would lead and train other such units.
"I take it things are not going well?" Yosef queried.
"They would be a disaster," said Dennis between clenched teeth. "The men are supposed to take turns leading different sized units. Instead, they spend most of the time arguing against orders, refusing orders, deliberately misinterpreting or delaying obeying orders, and fighting with different clans members or sometimes with one of the men working that day as a unit leader. I and the others in charge of this fiasco scream at the men till we're hoarse. Sometimes they listen, sometimes they ignore us, and even if they seem to understand what we're doing, as soon as we turn our backs, it all starts again. I know the idea is sound, but I think we should give up the idea of mixed clan units or operations."
Balwis sat smirking as he listened to Dennis's complaint.
"I watched a field exercise last 6 days. If anything, Dennis is too kind. I almost fell off my horse laughing."
Dennis glowered.
"It's not a laughing matter."
"No, of course not," said Yosef, heading off more heated words between the two men. Then he looked up, his eyes unfocused as he thought. The other three men waited, accustomed to Yosef's momentary absences, while he considered a problem or listened to whispers. 3 minutes passed, with the other three men sipping their beers and eyeing one another as they waited to see if Yosef had a pronouncement.
"Dennis," said Yosef, when he became present again. "Let's say a Metak man is a platoon leader that day and a Huel man doesn't follow orders. Is there any way to compel obedience?"
"Only if the Huel leader of the 100 does something. Even if he is so inclined, which isn't that often, he might be elsewhere at the time, and minutes or more can pass before the order is obeyed. Obviously, this doesn't work in a battle situation."
Yosef's lips parted, exposing a flickering tongue running over his teeth.
"What you need is a drill sergeant."
The English word sergeant was one of the labels Yosef suggested to identify men at different levels of command. But what a drill sergeant was, they had no idea and waited for Yosef's explanation. In many nations and armies, a drill sergeant is a man with authority over men in training. He may not be in the chain of command, but it's his duty to see that the men follow orders during training.
Yosef's explanation wasn't strictly accurate, but close enough for his purpose.
How is that any different from now? Complained Dennis. There's still the problem of obeying orders all the time, and not just when someone with authority is looking at them.
Maybe it was the beer, but Yosef eagerly anticipated watching the result of what he was about to suggest. The drill sergeant has authority to impose physical means, as well as yelling. The men need to worry more about displeasing the drill sergeant than they think about obeying orders from someone of a different clan. The idea is to get them used to obeying orders from whomever is in command.
Ball was snorted.
That's ridiculous. No clansman will stand for anyone pushing him around, much less striking him, if that's what you're implying. All it does is change the fight from men of two different clans to a clansman and this drill sergeant of yours.
Of course, said Yosef casually, looking at Balwas. The drill sergeant has to be someone so physically imposing and dangerous that the men will do what he says.
Balwas stared at Yosef, his face blank. Then his eyes flickered briefly to one side. Yosef didn't change his position, but from the corner of his eye, he could see Dennis's head turned toward Carnegie.
Sergeant Major.
Carnegie stood to one side and behind Dennis Vega on a platform, facing a mob of 500 men. Efforts to get the clansmen to form into ranks had proved fruitless and been abandoned. Dennis wasn't a small man, but Carnegie could easily see over Dennis's head and view all 500 men facing them. Most of the men waited for what Dennis would say, although as many as a quarter of the men remained engaged in conversations despite having been told to pay attention.
What a bunch of shitheads, Carnegie groused to Dennis.
Carnegie was from Swavebroke, a northern province, and the only clan whose members came evenly from the two colonization waves to populate Cadellium. As such, he was familiar with tensions between groups identifying themselves as from different backgrounds, even though members of the same clan. He listened to Dennis and watched the men's faces for their reactions to Dennis's words.
Sirs, today I am introducing you to Carnegie Poovy. Sir Poovy holds the rank of Sergeant Major. For your purposes, the responsibilities of this rank are to see that all men conduct themselves as expected, as members of a fighting unit from several different clans.
As Dennis spoke, Carnegie left the platform and walked toward the men. He didn't move quickly, but he strode directly at the mob, not saying a word. The front rank must have expected him to stop, but he didn't, and the first two men were jolted aside when Carnegie's bulk contacted them. Other men saw what happened and hurriedly pushed other men out of the way. Carnegie had bulldozed 10 yards into the mass before a man refused to give way. A big man, scarred and defiant-looking. Carnegie never lost a step as he backhanded the man, sending him and those he was flung against to the ground. Watching Carnegie's progress, Dennis continued his speech as if nothing had happened.
Sergeant Major Poovy is the bodyguard of Yosef Kolsko. And for those of you who don't know, he played a major role in the defense of St. Sidran's Abbey from the Baldorians and the fight against the Narthani at Moreland City. I advise you to listen to what he says, and it would be unfortunate if he is obliged to correct any of your actions or inactions.
Dennis tried not to let his stern expression morph into a smile.
Your hetman, and I'm referring to all five hetmen of the Five Clan Alliance, has approved Sergeant Major Poovy correcting any of you by any means necessary, if, in his opinion, you do not perform as you have been instructed. Sergeant Major Poovy will observe individual platoons and report to me on whether your training progresses in a satisfactory manner. Platoons not performing to Sergeant Major Poovy's approval or mine will find themselves with extra training and duties until performance improves. I should also tell you that all of your hetmen agreed that none of you will be allowed to return home until your performance is acceptable, no matter how long it takes.
Outcries at this news ranged from surprise to shock to anger. Dennis didn't explain that not all hetmen were pleased with the request that came from College Keelan to transfer temporarily authority over the clansmen. Only the Keelan hetman's reputation and their respect for him earned their acquiescence.
Dennis waited for the complaints to die down before continuing. There will also be two changes to the training routine. First is that a platoon from Keelan Dragoons, experienced from the Battle of Moreland City, will join the training. They will do everything your training platoons do and will serve as examples for you to observe and a gauge of how you're progressing. Although we don't expect you to equal the Dragoons, a performance that falls far too below theirs will trigger extra training and duties. The other change is that your platoons will engage in mock combat with the Dragoon platoon, who will wear copies of Narthani uniforms to let you more closely imagine facing the real Narthani. Dennis also neglected to mention the Keelan men's protests at the prospect of wearing Narthani colors and carrying a Narthani flag. It had taken Dennis an hour of patient explanation to convince the men it was for the good of the clan. Yosef had assured Carnegie and Dennis that the first platoon Carnegie worked with would be the most difficult, if Carnegie played his role well. The men carried unloaded weapons, there being no reason to chance one of the men losing control when subjected to the modified training regime. Each platoon was divided into four squads, with the platoon leader, called for the exercise a lieutenant, four squad leaders, sergeants, and two fire teams per squad, each fire team led by a corporal. The leadership positions rotated among the other platoon members to allow each man to gain experience leading mixed units and, not incidentally, enable identification of men slated for future leadership positions. The exercise this day consisted of squad tactics. Dennis gave the lieutenant a scripted list of maneuvers and commands that the squad and the fire team leaders would follow. Carnegie's first intervention came before the exercise began. The lieutenant stood in front of the five clusters of men, 10 from each clan and not intermixed. He looked at the sheets he had just been given, having no prior knowledge of their written contents. He started reading and stopped within seconds. He looked up quizzically to Dennis, who nodded to continue. The ageless lieutenant shrugged and read. From now on, to begin training at the beginning of each new exercise, or when the training staff wants to speak to us, we will form up in squad ranks we are assigned to. You all know your current assignments for today. Since they were posted on the announcement board at camp, and you were told to read the notice before training. The concept of parade formations had been new to the Gedeli when explained, and the execution of these formations would have put a Marine drill instructor into catatonia, were he to witness the Gedeli. The Islanders' disdain for the idea and grudging acquiescence when it occurred didn't help matters. The ageless lieutenant looked at the sheet again, glanced up at the 50 men, and, in a hesitant and less than commanding voice, continued reading from the sheet. Platoon! Fall in! The men looked at one another.
I think it means to form into ranks, like they showed us, said the lieutenant apologetically.
The men murmured among themselves, and about half of them moved to approximate positions, while the other half stayed where they originally stood. Carnegie walked over to the platoon leader.
Lieutenant, if you would stand over here.
Carnegie said politely in a low voice, although the tone and the vice-like grip on the ageless man's arm brooked no argument, as Carnegie pulled the man to a previously marked spot. Carnegie's mild tone vanished when he turned to the other men with a voice to shatter rock and a glower to shrivel walls.
"Now listen, you shitheads. You know who are supposed to be sergeants and corporals and which of the four squads you're in. So move your fucking asses before I have to help you."
Some of the men immediately began moving, though where they moved was not evident in the chaos. Others stood as if shocked or uncertain what to do. One man sneered and said something to a companion. Faster than anyone would have thought possible for someone Carnegie's size, a massive fist impacted the man's chest and knocked him to the ground, gasping for breath.
"Which squad does this particular shithead belong in?"
When no one answered immediately, Carnegie grabbed the prone man's companion with a hand on top of the man's head, his fingers splayed down as if in position to squeeze like a vise.
"Maybe you didn't hear me. I said, which squad does this shithead belong in?"
Carnegie's mild tone contrasted with his previous shouts and was, in its own way, more terrifying.
He's in squad 3, said the man, hardly more than a boy. "I'm in squad 2 and going to my position right away."
He ran toward the lieutenant before Carnegie could provide further assistance. Carnegie grabbed the now moaning man on the ground by an ankle and dragged him to an approximate position for squad 3. On the way, he called out for squad 3's sergeant. A Metok man came up to Carnegie, though he stayed out of immediate arm's length.
"You're the squad leader, and this is your man. It's your job to see he gets into rank as ordered by the lieutenant." "Now do your fucking job!"
The man blanched and grabbed the other ankle to help pull Carnegie's example into position. By the time the squad leader dropped him, most of the other men were in or on their way to their positions. Although the formation remained a disgrace, in a minute the men had lined up, sort of. The appearance would still have given a drill sergeant angina, and Yosef had told Dennis and Carnegie not to push the formation concept too far. The point was to get the men used to following orders. Carnegie shadowed the platoon for the rest of the morning, directly intervening several times. The men's constant glances to be sure they knew where Carnegie was inevitably slowed their responses to orders. Whenever he did step in, it was for failure to follow orders immediately and no longer for any instances of disrespect or laziness. At mid-morning, the leadership positions rotated to other men, and disorder reigned again, although not at the same level as the first set. Whether the improvement occurred because the new leaders were more focused or were worried about Carnegie, it wasn't clear. Near the end of the morning session, a drill at repositioning skirmish lines in a perpendicular position garnered Dennis's grudging admission that the performance wasn't too bad, even when a squad leader, barely 17 years old, found that keeping track of his men, watching out for Carnegie, and listening for orders from the lieutenant left little room to watch his own feet. He stepped into a hole, not injuring anything severely, but dropping his musket as his face hit a mud puddle. When Carnegie reached the boy, the lieutenant was already helping the miscreant to his feet and, red-faced, was about to begin yelling. Carnegie laid a hand on each man's shoulder.
"No problem, lieutenant,"
whispered Carnegie, which was an effort given the big man's normal rough voice.
"You're all doing much better. And everyone falls occasionally. The important point is to get back up and do your job. I'm sure the squad leader can do that. Can't you?"
The boy nodded, choked back tears, cleared his throat, and exclaimed,
"Yes, Sergeant Major!"
"Good," said Carnegie. "Now back at it."
Carnegie walked over to Dennis as the platoon started the drill over again.
"I think I've scared them enough for today. I'll be back tomorrow to frighten another platoon. Dennis choked back a laugh. I think it won't take much tomorrow. This platoon will be telling tales of Carnegie the Ogre and how best to obey orders before he rips out your throat.
Carnegie looked reproachfully at Dennis.
I'm acting this way because Yosef says it's for the men's own good, and I see his point. In a battle, not following orders can get everyone killed. But I don't like deliberately acting horrible.
It was on the tip of Dennis's tongue to say that Carnegie growled at people so easily it seemed to come naturally to him, but he could see Carnegie's sincerity and kept the thought to himself. The second day required fewer interventions by the new sergeant major, and direct competition with the Dragoon platoon solved most of the problems for men of different clans working together. 2 6 days later, Carnegie informed Yosef that he would host 2 platoons to an evening at the Snarling Greco II, the reward Carnegie had promised the first 2 mixed platoons who beat the Dragoons in simulated combat.
All of this is your idea, deadpanned the sergeant major. I figured it only reasonable you put up a reward. Call it my taking the initiative, as you say.
Ammunition. An increase in the guano mining fed the heightened paper cartridge production now ongoing in 6 Keelan cities and towns. In addition, the success at finally casting larger cannon added the need for cannon ammunition, and Yosef set up a factory in Kernford for the production of 6 and 12-pounder powder bags, along with tin cans holding canister and grapeshot for the 2 cannon calibers. The need for more workers at new tasks seemed never-ending. Wooden crates to hold musket and cannon ammunition for transport, limbers to hold ammunition, gun carriages, extra wheels, leather traces for wagons, cannon, and limbers, and on. They drew workers from every trade not deemed essential and likewise restricted orders for new work. A smithy had no time for decorative grills when cannon carriage parts and wheels were needed. A seamstress switched to cartridge or powder bags. The lantern maker switched part of his production to smaller lanterns that dragoons could carry for night movements. Stockpiling food. College had already ordered that all possible farmland go into production until further notice, and Merver fertilizer production ramped up in concert with gunpowder. Another commitment, College stated at the conclave, was to stockpile food, in case the Narthani interrupted food production. Kernford sat in a river valley, but deep caves penetrated the hills to the west and even deeper ones east in the mountains, and limestone caves honeycombed the valley. Interspersed among the many small cavities were a number of impressive caverns. While talking with College about how to store food, Yosef found out how the Keelanders kept their beer cold. He'd wondered about the many times, but never pursued the answer. He didn't realize that part of the answer lay with the odd tower structures, common in Kadeli towns, villages, abbeys, and individual dwellings of the more well-to-do. He'd assumed the narrow, mainly two-story towers were decorative when he thought about them at all. College explained that most towers rested above a limestone cavity below ground. Such cavities naturally stayed cooler than the ground above them. Some of the cavities had springs or streams running through them. When combined with the towers, which Yosef realized were wind catchers, the cavity environment could be kept cold and, in some cases, near freezing. Once prompted, he remembered reading about wind catchers in the Middle East on Earth. The wind catcher tower had openings at the top, facing the prevailing winds, with only a single opening if winds mainly came from one direction. The opening caught the wind and brought it down the tower to spaces below, and it exited elsewhere. With above-ground structures, the downward flow pushed out warmer air inside the internal spaces.
while additional cooling occurred due to airflow over surfaces. He recalled Persian towers that kept water reservoirs near freezing, and desert wind catchers capable of keeping the interior of thick-sided houses in frigid conditions while the outside temperature blazed. College also pointed out that in locations without limestone cavities, wind catchers were still useful in cooling. But in some provinces, ice houses had become common. Double and triple walled and roofed structures with straw and sawdust insulation. Workers brought ice blocks down from the mountains during the cold season and stored them for months in the ice houses. However, in certain locations, those options still proved insufficient to keep food from spoiling. Yosef's solution was carbon dioxide. A space filled with carbon dioxide reduced or eliminated threats from pests such as rats, which unfortunately had made the transplantation from Earth, along with some insects and molds. The gas also had the effect of retarding spoilage of fruits, vegetables, and grains. As with many of his innovations for the islanders, Yosef knew parts of the process, but not all of it. In this case, he knew carbon dioxide gas was heavier than air and would sink, and he knew how to generate the gas. He didn't know the details of how to combine this knowledge with the existing cooling techniques, which he hoped the local craftsmen could figure out. After Yosef talked with Kulich and convinced him that the carbon dioxide idea would work under some circumstances, Kulich had Petter Kenrick assemble a team of workers to figure out the details. Yosef explained that heated limestone gave off carbon dioxide gas. The island had a plentiful supply of limestone. The trick would be to modify cavities or caves so that they had sealed spaces to trap the sinking carbon dioxide. Above ground, the limestone was heated and the carbon dioxide funneled down to the cavity. Yosef repeated to all of the workers, ad nauseam, that once they'd begun to fill a cavity with gas, no one could descend until they'd blown out the gas using bellows and piping. This negative feature meant that once they'd stocked a cavity or a cavern with food stores and carbon dioxide, to tap the stores would require clearing the gas, then refilling the place with carbon dioxide once the people removing food had finished. The method would be practical only for large stores that people would infrequently access. A second method of making carbon dioxide involved heating sodium bicarbonate that occurred naturally as the mineral nacolite, a random tidbit of knowledge Yosef's enhanced memory pulled up. Among the numerous pieces of information, he didn't have a clue why those facts and not others existed in his memory. Of the two sources, they could gather limestone most easily, and it had the advantage of producing calcium oxide, known as quicklime on Earth, as a byproduct. Quicklime might not be immediately useful, but Yosef knew it as a component in steelmaking. People had used it in historical times as an early form of poison gas, as a dispersed caustic powder, and it could be used to make high-intensity lights, which was the origin of the word limelight, the illumination used in theaters before electricity. He told the men working on the food storage project to save the calcium oxide, figuring they'd have time and a need for it later. He had visions of flares and searchlights. 2 6 days later, Petter Kenrick updated Yosef on the food storage plans. The men working on his idea of filling storage chambers with carbon dioxide had progressed, although they decided to limit the gas-flooded chambers to only certain sites and foods, particularly fruits and vegetables and their processed versions, and sites storing meats and cheeses, where they expected access to be limited. Cured meats, dry sausage, and hard cheeses would make up much of the prepared foods. They would also store grains, but as much as possible would turn them into island versions of hardtack, flour mixed with minimal water and baked completely dry. By keeping the hardtack from moisture, they could make it last years, especially under carbon dioxide to keep out insects.
Yosef remembered reading a memoir about the U.S. Civil War, where soldiers in both the North and the South lived largely on hardtack they would crush and mix with water or coffee, sometimes frying the mush if oil or fat was available.
Yosef didn't appreciate the scale of food storage being planned by Clan Keelan until he sat in on a meeting of college with Vortig Lewis and Petter Kenrick. Kenrick was in charge of organizing the food reserves, and he summarized a massive program. With Keelan being so well organized, the clan headquarters kept a running estimate of animals and large grain stores, as well as data on the population. According to Kenrick's numbers, Keelan province had 190,000 cattle, 270,000 Krikors, an Anyar species, roughly filling the niches of sheep and goats and about the same size, and 80,000 horses. Also, families commonly kept combinations of ducks, geese, ruktors, Anyarian flightless bird analogs, and conies, rabbit analogs. Currently, people had more cattle and Krikors than usual, because the farmers' inability to ship grain off the island had led many to use excess grain to increase herds, a strategy Bronwyn Merton Linton had explained to Yosef before their affair. They hoped that if the Narthani ever lifted the embargo, the clans could turn the animals into cured meats for external trade. In other words, food could be stored easier on the hoof. Keelan put plans into place for meat to be salted, smoked, or turned into dry sausage. The processing would start up incrementally, with facilities prepared to ramp up production if the situation with the Narthani worsened. Unfortunately, plant products required different strategies, which brought the existing methods in Yosef's carbon dioxide into play. They had already stored grain in silos, warehouses, and below ground. Although farmers had reduced acreage, the equivalent of 2 years' crop still sat idle, even counting spoilage and pests. Similarly, both farms and families widely grew root vegetables, turnips, beets, and several Anyarian species with a similar look and taste to potatoes, but didn't store them in large quantities. Much of the current practice would soon change. College intuited, as did Yosef and Mera, that the next year would prove critical. As part of the expanded crop production, Yosef's fertilizer project went from stasis to full-scale production, using 30 men mining at Birdshit Bay, transporting guano to Abersford and crushing it there, and distributing the fertilizer throughout Keelan. The worst-case scenario with the expansion of crop production would be if they were wrong. Then the farmers would have wasted their efforts. Yet if the premonitions about the Narthani came true, the clan would require every pound of food it could generate. Ranchers couldn't increase meat production as fast as crops, but the headman asked clan members to reduce beef consumption to half of normal and to allow calves that they would have butchered for veal to mature further. Krikor herders received different orders. Krikors provided wool, and while people considered the meat inferior to beef, it was edible and made respectable sausage, if spiced enough. A Krikor ewe could give birth twice a year, with two or three young each time. Herders normally exerted population control by limiting the number of male Krikors. The clan now lifted that limitation, which meant the Krikor herds could easily double in size within a year. If the need for stored foods didn't materialize, the clan could severely cull the herds in a year or two. Other less extensive plans included increasing bird flocks and smoking the meat, the clan's fishermen hauling in everything they could to be dried or smoked, and encouraging farms and families to plant large vegetable gardens and preserve the products and the fruit by drying them. Yosef explained the principles of canning, a method of food preparation that he remembered hadn't been developed on Earth until after the Napoleonic Wars, early to mid-1800s,
However, the lack of infrastructure to produce enough sealable glass or metal containers appeared to make this option impractical for the time being. Nevertheless, in a few places, people used multi-gallon glass jugs for canning. They developed several bulk storage sites, with the main one in the Diligon Mountains. Only a single pass crossed over the mountains to the Dornfeld district, and no army could force the pass if the clans even moderately defended it. There, within a series of high valleys to be protected at each end of the pass by impregnable fortifications, the clan's ultimate redoubt would be built. Every clan member would try to reach this location should the worst happen. They would turn deep caverns into storage sites, and hundreds of men already worked to make chambers sealable to use Yosef's idea for carbon dioxide-facilitated preservation and to build wind catchers to cool chambers. Given the altitude, they also planned to use existing deep ice caves and to bring block ice to shallower caves. Although housing for potentially tens of thousands of clan members would be primitive when they arrived, the heavily forested mountains would provide shelter and heat. If necessary, they would fell the entire forest to create a safe haven. Forests would grow again. Clan members lost would be lost forever. The biblical scale of Clan Keelan's planning awed Yosef. Yet it also made Yosef's blood run cold, because the scope of the planning clearly revealed the worst fears of the clan leadership. Still time for home. Finding time to write in his journals became harder and harder, as did Yosef's physical workouts. He maintained a once or twice a month session with Y4 Kales on blade fighting, combining the session with half an hour of target practice. No matter how many demands pressed on Yosef, he scrupulously reserved time to eat morning and evening meals with Mara. His other pleasant moments consisted of waking up or just before he fell asleep, with him and Mara in bed together, sometimes holding each other, sometimes not quite touching. Their coupling became less frequent as Mara's stomach grew, with Yosef expressing concern for her and the baby, and Mara assuring her husband everything was fine and that she would tell him if the time came to stop. The time hadn't come one night, when afterward they lay naked, arms and legs intertwined. A sheen of sweat from both bodies mixed and added to their sense of bonding. "Is it still kicking a lot?" He ran a hand over the mound, then exclaimed, "Oh, I guess there's the answer." Her abdomen rippled with internal activity. "No question," she laughed. "He's an active one. I think we'll have our hands full once he learns to walk. Still think it's a boy? Keelan needs an heir, so yes, it's a boy," asserted Mara. Yosef didn't argue that her assertion wouldn't likely carry weight with nature. Yet when Mara made up her mind this strongly, he found it best not to contradict her without a good reason. He stroked her bulge. "How soon before it, he, comes?" "Another month to a month and a half." "Another?" "Wait a minute," Yosef thought. "That's not right. That would be 8.5 to 9 Anyar months, each of which is 36 days. Yosef kept quiet while he did quick calculations. That would make the gestation between 310 and 324 days, compared to an average of 270 days on Earth. Then he remembered to factor in that the days here equaled 23 hours on Earth. Taking the day-length difference into account, he figured the gestation period on Anyar was equivalent to about a month longer than on Earth. "The moon cycles?" he wondered. "I know women's menstrual cycles are longer here, matching their moons just as on Earth. Why would that change gestation? Maybe it's the higher gravity, making the fetus develop slower? One more thing to remind me, this
isn't Earth.
His hand wandered up to a breast, massaging it gently and rolling the nipple with his thumb. Mara tensed as her nipple stood erect.
Don't tell me you're ready again so soon.
No, he said sedately. It's just a nice thing to play with.
Play with? She said with mock indignation. Is that what I am, a toy?
Do you object?
She giggled. Not really. Though I'll admit it took time getting used to having a man touch me everywhere. And the other way, too.
One of her hands moved down below his stomach and cupped his genitals.
Yes, I see you're not recovered yet. Give it time. Although if you keep doing that, the time may be short. I wondered if you would still be interested in coupling when I got so big. I think the last half hour answered that question. I worried that after the baby comes, I wouldn't look appealing, because some women have stretch marks, and their bodies never look the same. I'm glad you told me how to avoid the marks.
Yosef knew the marks were due to connective tissue fibers breaking under the stress of rapid growth, leaving scars. Months earlier, after hearing Mara voice that worry, he mentioned that some women in his homeland did things to avoid the marks, such as applying oils or lotions to their bodies as they swelled, exercising regularly, and exfoliating their skin to encourage new skin cell production. He didn't think to mention that the methods probably didn't have any effect. At that particular moment, he had been remembering how Julie had read everything she could find on the internet and planned to follow every suggestion. He had researched it himself and found no evidence that any of the approaches proved effective. Genetics remained the best predictor of stretch marks. If a woman's mother had gotten them, a new mother-to-be would likely get them too. However, his reservations about the methods such as using oils and lotions subsided into silence when Mara informed him she had spoken with a major Kernford soap maker who had decided to market a lotion for prospective mothers to prevent stretch marks. Well, he told himself, it won't do any harm and probably feels good. Yosef and Mara held and stroked each other for several minutes. Then Mara unwrapped herself and looked at Yosef's face, lit by candlelight.
Yosef, you've been different somehow since you came back from the conclave.
Different? How?
I'm not sure, said Mara. Maybe calmer, though that isn't quite what I sense. More assured? No, that's not exactly right either. You tell me. Did something happen at the conclave you haven't told me about?
I told you what happened. I don't know myself how it affected me. It can be confusing. There I was standing in front of that room full of hetmen and advisors and thinking to myself how every one of them was more experienced in life and at leading men than I am. Yet there I was giving advice as if I knew what I was talking about, and somehow seeming, believing I did, or acting like it anyway. I've talked in front of rooms of people before, but then I spoke about topics I felt confident about. That experience didn't match the one with the conclave audience. Still, I spoke and afterward thought I had done well. Then, by the end of the conclave, I could see that I'd convinced very few people of some of the major points I'd tried to make. Your father assured me I was wrong, and it just took a while for many hetmen to mull over things before acting. Even if he's right, my instincts are that we don't have time to waste. The trip back gave me time to think. And I've come to understand his point. I just chafe at the slow progress.
I also seem to be coming around to accepting that I can't hide as much as I'd like in my projects, my writings, you and the baby when it comes. Like it or not, I'm involved in advising. Although things have worked out so far, I'm still afraid I'll advise something that turns into a disaster. But I have to stop forgetting that other people are part of all this. And it's not totally on me, whether the outcome is bad or good. He remained quiet a moment, and Mara could tell he was gathering a thought. It's just that I don't see myself as a leader like the other men of the Conclave. Mara took a minute to think about what he'd said. Yosef, what is a leader? Aren't there different kinds? Father is certainly one. He leads the clan. Dennis is a leader. He's led men in battle. Abbot Sistian is a leader. People listen to him and respect him. Maybe you don't lead a clan or hundreds of men in battle, but aren't you somewhat like Sistian? People listen to you. People like Father, Dennis, Lewis, and Kenrick. They don't just listen, they respect you. Carnegie is your friend, so it may be hard to tell, but I'm sure he has respect for you. If nothing else, I remember him being impressed that you stood and fought at St. Sidron's, even when you admitted you were afraid. He respected that. What about Kales and Balwis? Neither of them may be a friend, but I can't imagine either of them attaching themselves to you as they have unless there's a high level of respect. Hard men like that don't hang around other men who are weaker fools. You are a leader, Yosef. Whether or not you believe it. He sighed. I understand what you're saying, Mara. And part of me knows it's true. Still, I'm unsure about trying to be a leader. What if I make mistakes? Everyone makes mistakes, especially leaders. Father readily admits when he makes one. But he forges on, trying not to make the same mistake again. I think you do what is necessary, Yosef, even if sometimes I wish you'd act sooner. I know you are reticent to give advice on serious matters, though I admit I don't understand why. I tell myself to be patient and let you do what is needed in your own time. Not mine.